Welcome to session 271. This is the Imagining Mormonism at Mid-Century. If you were looking for, if you were looking for how the succession crisis is solved, that is in room 200D. Before we begin, we ask that cell phones are turned off and that those attending will be respectful and attentive. It's the mission of Sunstone to host thoughtful and respectful dialogue. We invite all here to practice looking at the Mormon experience as legitimate Mormon experiences, no matter how diverse they may be. This session is being recorded, and you will be able to purchase it after the presentation ends at the registration desk at the main floor. We also hope you are taking time to purchase goods from the vendors, including booksellers like Benchmark Books. Please support Mormon Studies by supporting our vendors. This session is 90 minutes long, and we ask both the audience and the presenters to keep it within the time frame. After this session, many attendees are gathering at the local Crown Burger. It's a Utah tradition. Please return on time for our plenary with Linda K. Klein, who will be speaking on the parallels between the evangelical and Mormon purity movements. Seats will be filling up quickly. So about this presentation. 30 years ago, no one, likely not even the prophets and visionaries, could have imagined today's LDS church, especially with the advent of modern technology like the internet, iPhones, and other inventions. So how can we begin to imagine the church at mid-century? This session consists of a panel of futurists and other visionaries who gaze into the globe of the future to tell us what the church may be like in 30 years. Attendees will be invited to preset their own soothsaying prognostications. Hopefully I said that right. So a little bit about the presenters. Bob Rees is co-founder and current vice president of the Bountiful Children's Foundation. Over the past decade, he has worked on behalf of malnourished children in Guatemala, the Philippines, Colombia, Haiti. And most recently in Madagascar. Janice Spangler is a certified integral professional coach. She works with Symmetry Solutions, where she specializes in working with individuals and couples affected by faith transitions. She is a student at the Living School and the Center for Action and Contemplation. And Jay Griffith facilitates two monthly discussion groups, Faith Again and Think Again. He serves African refugees through an LDS branch. By profession, Jay is a designer, art, creative director. By avocation, he mindfully runs in the mountains. He and his wife, Jane, live in Mill Creek, Utah. And now for the presentation.
So I begin with a little promotion of the Bountiful Children's Foundation. My wife and I spent a wonderful 3 weeks in Madagascar in April, and it was we've got a booth out here that you can go and just learn about our work, so it's an opportunity. Mormonism at mid-century, imagining the church of the future. Just think about that. Church of the future. If you had been living 30 years ago, which I assume all of you were, because none of you are that young enough to be my, could you have imagined today? Could you have imagined this with the Louvre and the Library of Congress and the world on it? And I would imagine that in 30 years, our great-grandchildren were saying, I keep hearing you talk about cell phones and cars. What in the world were those things? So we begin with a couple of quotes about the imagination, since the future depends on it. Perhaps the imagination is the true organ of purposeful design in our evolution, directing all change. That is, the power to imagine was embedded in us from the beginning. That was by Ihab Hassan, a humanist. Albert Einstein said, imagination is more important than knowledge, for knowledge is limited to all we now know and understand. while imagination embraces the entire world and all there ever will be to know and understand. I am one of those people who loves the Oxford English Dictionary. And this is what it says. Imagination is the creative faculty of the mind in its highest aspect, the power of framing new and striking conceptions. What is known today as the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, as well as what is known as Mormonism, and they're not the same, includes not only the institutional church, but the social, cultural, political, and theological worlds that are encompassed by that term. It is, to a large extent, a product of Joseph Smith's imagination. By that, I don't mean that, like Athena's birth, the restoration, Athena's birth from the mind of Zeus, that the restoration sprang fully formed from Joseph's mind, but rather that in its essential contours and promises, Mormonism had both its generation and its germination within the prophet's fertile, God-inspired, Christ-lighted mind. And just to be clear, this does not mean that I take the position held by some contemporary Latter-day Saints that Joseph Smith was the author of the Book of Mormon or the Pearl of Great Price. Rather, that he was the author of other wonderfully radical texts and doctrines and visions of Mormonism. Rather, I contend that the prophet had the rare kind of open and imaginative mind and spirit into which God could open and pour the revelations of the restoration. God chose an unlettered boy because he was open to receiving what God wanted to restore. Not everybody may believe that, but I do. Harold Bloom, the great critic, seemed to recognize this when he said famously that the Mormon prophet, quote, was an authentic religious genius who surpassed all Americans. That includes Emerson and Whitman and a lot of other people. All Americans before and since in the possession and expression of what could be called the religion-making imagination. There had to be, he says, an immense power in the myth-making imagination of Joseph Smith at work to sustain so astonishing an innovation as Mormonism. But of course we know that it was more than myth-making. It was also revelation-receiving and Joseph Smith imagining and inspiring his followers. That's why, of all of the religions from 19th century America, the one that has not only survived, but has thrived, and thrived gloriously, is the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Another way to put this is that Joseph's mind and imagination seem not to have been limited by convention, timidity, institutional reticence, or conformity. It seemed to me unlimited in its openness. As he famously said, the things of God are of deep import, and time and experience and careful and ponderous and solemn thoughts can only find them out. In other words, people who say the gospel is beautifully simple and simply beautiful don't know the gospel, because it's more than that. And that depth is what Joseph Smith was like Milton and like Hawthorne. They were divers. They were deep, deep divers. And so he says, thy mind, O man, or O woman, if thou will lead a soul into salvation, must stretch as high as the utmost heavens and search and contemplate the darkest abyss and the broad expanse of eternity. Thou must commune with God. According to Kathleen Flake, quote, Smith's narrative history of human and divine interaction was ultimately oriented to a future time that served as a basis for acting in the present. It provided a world of meaning by which his believing readers understood themselves existentially, including their future and not merely their past. Which is precisely what I'm proposing, that we orient ourselves to a reimagined future of the church by acting in the present. Flake adds, quote, most fundamentally, Smith's writings give his believing readers a different sense of what was and what will be. That is the future. Joseph Smith, not only the past and the present, but oriented toward the future. If V.H. Roberts was right in stating that, quote, not half, not 100th part, not 1,000th part of that which Joseph Smith revealed to the church has yet been unfolded either to the church or to the world. That's an astonishing statement. Not 1,000th part of what was revealed to Joseph Smith has yet been unfolded to the church or to the world. If that's the case, then the possibilities for imagining the church of the future are almost limitless. Our calling to do this may be especially urgent at this time when the church is experiencing significant internal and external challenges. What might Joseph Smith say if he could speak to us today? If we believe, as the Doctrine and Covenants promises, that God will yet reveal many great and important things pertaining to the kingdom of God, we have to be bold to think that some of those revelations might come to ordinary Latter-day Saints like us. It wouldn't be the first time. In the middle of the 19th century, under tremendous hardship and the cost of many lives, our pioneer forebears took months to drive covered wagons and push hand carts across the plains from Omaha, Nebraska to Salt Lake City. 150 years later, it takes less than 14 hours to cover the same distance by car and less than 2 hours by plane. In 30 years, it might take less than 20 minutes. Even the most visionary Mormons in the mid-1850s and 1860s could not have imagined the technological and scientific revolution that has transformed the modern world in the past century and a half. Any one of the thousands of innovations which we take for granted would have been considered by them as miracles or science fiction fantasies. If it was impossible for the pioneers to see our day, and even those saints who were living a decade ago to see our day, it may be just as difficult or impossible for us to look into the future. That is, as powerful as our imaginations are, they are limited to a large extent by the confines of our time, the contours of our experience, and the richness of our memories. In an Atlantic article called Imagining the Future is Just Another Kind of Memory, Julie Beck says that we project the future by what we remember of the past. Imagining the future, she says, is a kind of nostalgia because humans predict what the future will be like by using their memories of what's already happened. For this reason, most of us have difficulty imagining much beyond what we already know or imagine. I remember seeing Back to the Future, and there were a couple of things they got right, but some things they were absolutely wrong about. Nevertheless, imagining is something that compels us as human beings. The poet Wallace Stevens says, we live in the imagination. And if something's wrong with the world, it's because we're not living in it enough. So, nevertheless, imagining is something that compels us as human beings. We are wired to look beyond the horizon, to contemplate the next steps and the next journey, to anticipate tomorrow and beyond. To quote Buzz from Toy Story, our quest is for infinity and beyond. One might argue that that is among our chief callings as Latter-day Christians. Our goal today is a little less ambitious than infinity, let alone and beyond. So we are tasked with trying to imagine what the church would be like in 30 years, in 2050, to imagine how Mormonism, including through the lens of the present and possible future technologies, can transform itself and play a more effective, dynamic role in fulfilling its mission, thereby helping to transform the future. Laman and Lemuel complained that their father Lehi was a visionary man. But his vision, shared and expanded by his son Nephi, led his people to a promised land, one far and beyond the confines and limitations of Jerusalem and the Arabian desert. Imagine if you are Nephi, and you feel from the vision you've had, the Lord has called you to something beyond your imagination. And he says, by the way, after you've traveled for a number of years across this desert, you'll have to build a ship. Somebody who's lived in the desert, that must have seemed like something insane. As Latter-day Saints, we are a visionary people, but we have become so comfortable in our technologically sophisticated world, in our religious certainty, that I would guess that we are not much better equipped to look into the opaque glass of the future than were our ancestors to look into ours. As the editor of an issue of the New York Times Sunday magazine devoted to the future said, quote, if we are honest with ourselves, our view ahead has never seemed murkier. That's because the problems that most haunt our world today, climate change and pollution, inequality and war, are problems for which technology, long our spur to envisioning a better future, looks more like the cause than the solution. Our future is hard to imagine because we have trouble imagining how we can act to improve it. Some Latter-day Saints think it's folly to imagine a future because they feel our energy should be put into, quote, hastening the day of the Lord's coming. Perhaps it is instructive to remember the parable of the 10 virgins, including the 5 who forgot to charge their cell phones. Could I be so bold as to suggest our vision of the church might include its engagement with such big problems as climate change, immigration, war, and the fate of the family? Any consideration of the future must include technology which can make the future brighter, or it can make it darker, because the history of technology shows that both of those avenues are open to us. Perhaps Latter-day Saints will invent new technologies that will have a positive impact on the future of the church and the world. After all, Latter-day Saints were responsible for inventing television. You can curse or bless whoever did that. Traffic lights, artificial heart surgery, hearing aids, for which I'm personally grateful. Electric guitars, which Robert Crispus is grateful for, being a rock and roll musician. Maybe we can come up as Latter-day Saints with the next big thing. Perhaps our hope, however, lies in our ability to fashion second-order instrumentality or specialized technology derived from simpler technologies. Perhaps our greatest contribution will be employing advanced human capabilities such as imagination, intuition, empathy, compassion, and especially love, which can help us to control and effectively utilize the technologic instrumentality to some higher end. Maybe more to the point is how can Latter-day Saints employ technology, both human and invented, to fulfill the church's fourfold mission and thereby help transform the world? Representing less than 0.5% of the world's population, is it grandiose to even consider that possibility? Keep in mind that according to the church itself, there are no more than 5 million active Latter-day Saints in the world. In the Doctrine and Covenants, the Lord speaks of the church as his little flock. He might say today, my eensy, weensy, beansy flock that we are. Well, today we're going to have some panelists who address this question. So I am regretful to say that our technological visionary, Galen Murdoch, who is my wife, Gloria's son, and my stepson, who is a real crackerjack when it comes to this, had an engagement with an ATV. You use that in the sense that's an all-terrain vehicle. But when my wife said, Galen has had a problem with ATV, I thought, well, that shouldn't be such a big problem. We all have problems with our TVs. Anyway, Galen will not be here to participate in that. But when I talked to him today, he had all of these ideas about what he was going to do in this session. So I said, okay, I'm going to talk to Lacey, Lindsay, and next year we're going to have an entire symposium, a session at Sensan devoted to the technology and the church of the future. So it's just delayed gratification for that. So we will hear. Jay, are you going first? Okay. So we'll hear first from Jay Griffith. Jay Griffith, last year I started a session called Radiant Mormonism, and I interviewed Jay as a person that I consider a radiant Latter-day Saint, and he indeed is. He is the guiding light behind two really important initiatives here in the Salt Lake area called Faith Again and Think Again, and if you don't know about them, you really need to. These are two dynamic communities which Jay is responsible for, and he recognizes that imagining the future takes both faith and thought, and he will probably tell you also abundant love. Our second presenter is Janice Spangler, an integral professional coach and dedicated student of personal growth, who's going to help us imagine how we can have better relationships to establish a Zion community, and perhaps how those relationships might be realized or imagined in the future. Following their presentations, I will report on an informal survey I conducted inviting a spectrum of Latter-day Saints to imagine the church of the future. I sent out a survey and said, imagine what the church is going to be like at mid-century. Send me what you would like it to be like. And then we'll open this up to how some of you might imagine the church of the future. So we'll turn time over first to Jay and then to Jana.
Grateful to be here. Two quotes, one from a corporate visionary and one from a famous physicist. Trying to predict the future is like driving down a country road without lights, looking out the back window. That's Peter Drucker. And the purpose of thinking about the future is not to predict it, but to raise people's hopes. That's Freeman Dyson. What I hope to see in our church by mid-century is rooted in a deep appreciation for our core theology and structure, and our colorful history, and our marvelous community of saints that has greatly blessed my life and so many others. As an only child of convert parents growing up in a branch in the southern Oregon coast, the church became my extended family. Not only did it teach me many good principles, but gave me the opportunity to practice them and have abundant, meaningful, and helpful relationships that I otherwise would not have had. My parents met at church, as did my wife and I. My profession, as well as many of my other passions and pursuits, have been come through the church. This creating of diverse, fruitful relationships continues to this very moment with my friends Bob and Jana, and now with you. My appreciation and hope for the church, as well as my concerns, are also informed by my exploring scripture, science, philosophy, psychology, economics, technology, religions, nature, art, history, and a wee bit of fiction thrown in. And my monthly Think Again and Faith Again discussion groups over the last 6 years have been immensely fruitful. You know, just in the past several weeks, I have witnessed much to give me hope about this church in 30 years. Here's just four I could mention. I received an email from the church that contained information on creating a culture of inclusion at church, supporting missionaries who come home early, and talking about sexual abuse. I read how the church helped produce and implement an effective financial literacy course for a poverty-plagued black inner city. Doing so involved working closely with the Reverend Teresa Deer, among others. This resulted in President Nelson being invited to speak at the National NAACP Convention. And the head of the NAACP, Reverend Brown, said, quote, speaking of Nelson, he set the trail for us to follow by being humble. It was a humble gesture on the part of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints to make overtures to the NAACP to say, we had a checkered past on this issue, and we want to do something about it. It was more than just talk, end of quote. And then I read a glowing report on Facebook of a transgender friend, along with a gay and a lesbian person, who were invited to speak in a sacrament meeting last Sunday. Finally, each week, I see abundant gifts of time, talents, money, goods, and love given at the African Refugee Branch that I serve in. I see the church institutionally and as individuals doing truly remarkable work to help some of the most displaced. I express this optimism, having experienced some harm and heartache from the institution and seen harm come to others because of it. All of my children and their wives have left, and my wife has left. While this leaving isn't all on the church will need to continue to change in some fundamental ways to stem the bleeding. And it will require all of us to recognize that loving, committed relationships always bear the scars of love born from the thorns and nails of our incompetence. It is these fundamentals that I want to imagine with you and give you some reasons to hope. Right or wrong, most of us have a list of things we'd like to see changed. But the most needed and culturally challenging changes can only come through lay members and leadership grappling with and reimagining essential elements of our institutional church and its Jesus. Here's what I hope to see by mid-century. Imagine with our house of faith a simpler and more faith-driven theology in the family room, and adjacent to it, a generous and diverse world library to explore the best books and ideas. Less focus on salvatory procedure and afterlife detail, and more on commitments to personal relationships and community and ways of being that promote human flourishing in the present. Imagine focusing on the most essential doctrine, as Joseph Smith taught, the character of God, that the character of our heavenly parents is love, as best expressed through Jesus' life and teachings. Imagine anchoring our religion to the two great commandments and live like love is what everything else hangs on. The golden rule rules. Imagine a church where who and how we love is the standard by which we measure the correctness of our teachings, policies, and revelations. If any of these conflict with God's golden rule by limiting a person's ability to receive all the same opportunities that a heterosexual male has, then we will question it. If Scripture or Revelation portrays a God who is jealous, vengeful, genocidal, or manipulative, then we will judge it as Moroni directs in the light of Christ and his teachings on charity. Imagine a church that more fully appreciates how all revelations are partly cloudy conversations with God, often illuminated or darkened by our own shadows. Imagine a church membership who continues to accept more communal responsibility for the teachings and direction of the church, as well as their personal relationship to God, where, like our Jewish friends, we midrash our most fundamental revelations and doctrines to create the continuing revelation we need to thrive. Imagine how this will enable us to move beyond what feels like immovable doctrines, such as D&C 138, "What I, the Lord, have spoken, I have spoken, and I excuse not myself," and allow apology and the recognition of imperfect revelation. Imagine no longer feeling uncertainty, but embracing it as one of our articles of faith. Imagine, aided by technology, our apostles and prophets leading in a more transparent way, providing membership a view into their deliberations, their discussions, their disagreements, and the distribution of church funds. Imagine them encouraging bottom-up revelation by directly asking the membership, as well as ward councils, for the revelatory input and ideas. Such member surveys and focus groups are already quite common. Imagine a clear delineation of revelation and priesthood leadership. Our apostles and prophets being recognized and appreciated for their earnest discipleship, leadership, ministering, and revelation, but not as exclusive prophetic voices. Imagine them teaching and encouraging exploration of all the world's prophetic voices, including from the arts and sciences, even if they are agnostic or atheist. Imagine a priesthood that is harder to abuse because of greater leadership diversity in gender, race, culture, and sexual orientation. And because sustaining and common consent is taken seriously. More than a perfunctory habit of raising the right hand, it will also be utilized to sustain policy, procedure, and doctrine. Imagine us embracing our leadership with more generosity of heart, more patience, and less hero worship. More able to recognize that our leaders put their revelatory pants and skirts on like the rest of us. Not being offended that their culture and life experience influences their revelation, or that reaction to external pressures can't be part of prophetic leadership. Word of wisdom, anyone? Like Peter, Alma, or Joseph Smith, we have all experienced penitent revelation by being brought to our knees by outside forces. Do I hear an amen? Imagine a church that once again can feel like home for many who now feel estranged. They may not return or stay, but most, if not all, of the stumbling blocks will have been removed. Imagine more of us being yoked with Christ rather than being yoked to only an institution. Creating a more welcoming and transformative space for the sinner, unorthodox, and heretic, as well as those of different faiths or no faith in God at all. Imagine less emphasis on conformity of beliefs and more on becoming like Christ. Less checking off boxes for exaltation and more checking in with our conscience and those who need our heart and hands. We will be the gathering place, a place to come home to in a world often contentious and divided, but curious, where people can passionately disagree yet speak to each other with warmth and respect, where constructive conversation conveyed through Christian love finds common cause in compassion to bless all humanity, where we productively address some of the most pressing issues of the day, such as poverty, addiction, extortion, and dysfunctional families, as well as climate change and the ethical dilemmas posed by the technological revolution in robotics, artificial intelligence, virtual reality, and gene editing. Imagine our Sunday and weekly meetings more holy. More holy by being more wholly inclusive. Not just from the diversity of people who attend, but by utilizing teachings from other faith traditions, as well as current research and luminaries outside religion. Imagine welcoming big questions, doubts, and personal trials by providing a safe place to be vulnerable, to ease each other's burdens, lift up the hands that hang down, strengthen the feeble knees, and mourn with those that mourn. Imagine our ward houses becoming neighborhood resource centers, utilized for a variety of community needs by any worthy group. Our buildings reinvented or retrofitted to become beacons of environmentally thoughtful design and construction, simple and aesthetic, with spaces inviting quiet meditation and communion with nature and the divine. Now dream really big. Imagine smaller temples, beautifully simple, austere, and less costly, that inspire us to be more connected to each other and all creation, and be less materialistic. Their design, construction, and operation utilizing the best environmental practices, thereby inviting all who see or enter to join the common cause of caring for the earth and each other. Imagine climate change uniting the world globally and our church being a light on a hill, bringing its rich theology, practical priesthood, and reimagined earth-caring, Christ-bonding rituals and covenants to heal. They will be literally life-saving ordinances for the living, the dying, and the dead. Imagine all humanity being invited to such an experience, and that the only question asked at the temple doors is, are you earnestly and sincerely striving to follow Christ's teachings? I'd hoped to show this ad that I recently saw, but we can't get Wi-Fi on her laptop, so I'll describe it to you. It portrays the church that I imagine, and that I'm sure many of you imagine. And it's really how it already is in so many ways. Oh, wait, maybe we can get it up. In the meantime, for the Q&A, start imagining what you want to see the church as so we can hear from you. So some of you might be familiar with Faith Matters. It's a really lovely organization. I'm on the board of it. And they're working closely with the Neil A. Maxwell Institute at BYU, doing some very forward-thinking things. But one of the founders, Bill Turnbull, recently wrote this little article about the church and put this commercial on that the church had done, this ad, which is really thoughtful.
I've just been helping, so I'm not really...
You're doing awesome. I told Bob this is why I was just going to tell you about the commercial.
This is church.
How many could hear all that? Did everybody hear it? Okay, great. Thank you. This ad captures so much of what I picture the church in mid-century, and interestingly, it's so much of who we already are. We just need to keep being the change we want to see and do it with charity. Thank you.
So I'm just going to speak from down here, if that's okay. Yeah, no, I'm great. I can do this. Thank you, Jay. That's such a beautiful vision. I just think it's lovely. I think it's so interesting just hearing how we imagine things. First of all, I wasn't hired for my tech savvy or for my PowerPoint skills. But for me, I think it when we prognosticate this way and imagine, it says a whole lot more about us than it does maybe even what we're predicting, right? I don't know how much accuracy there is in any of this, but, you know, it'll sure say something about me, which is super vulnerable. I like to talk about ideas, and I like to talk about framings and other things. And so, you know, when Bob asked me to do this, I'm like, okay, sure. And I've just realized what a vulnerable thing it is, just wrestling with my own hopes and then saying, no, I can't hope for that. Oh, you know, that won't happen. And I'm a realist, and I'm a one on the Enneagram. So I see all the problems. I see all the barriers. So I hope you bear with me, because, you know, I wish I could just live in Jay's world and his head for a while, because I just think that is a beautiful place and gives us far more hope maybe than I do. So, okay. So for me, I am a person, this is my fourth session today, so I am so sorry if you've already seen this framing today, but I'm a framing girl. Like, I like to use maps. And so one of the maps that I use is levels of consciousness, okay? So there are many, many, many maps for levels of consciousness even. There are many researchers that have done this work over the past 50 to 60 years. But the one thing that we do know about all of these different things, of all of these different kinds of framings, is that consciousness expands over time. It does with individuals, and it does with groups. You know, any kind of a group is just a collective of individuals, and so there's going to be sort of a center of gravity that emerges from any particular group at any given time. And this doesn't happen in a really nice, easy, linear way. You know, different civilizations are going to advance at different rates in different ways. You know, if you imagine Tibet, for instance, they have really done a lot of growth in spirituality over the last thousands of years, sitting in caves and imagining, you know, communion with God. But yet, technologically, they're still largely at yak butter, right? So we all go at different rates in different places. So, you know, but this is very general. And this map is very, very general. The one thing I do feel like we do is we do continue to grow and develop and expand our consciousness. So if I'm if I just have access today to just me, tomorrow it's going to be my family, then it's going to be my community. You know, years from now I'll be able to take in the needs of the world, the needs of the planet, and so forth, okay? So this particular modeling of this kind of shows this, and you tend to include where you've come from, although where you've just come from seems really threatening for some reason as we go through growth. But I would theorize that our faith among many Western churches are center of gravity is somewhere between the blue and the orange levels here. And you can kind of see what maybe the driving value is, even though I don't know that we would say this is the driving value, but when push comes to shove and things are put up against each other, we tend to preference some of this. So the blue is order. We are a church of order. We are really awesome at the order. We have rules and procedures and ways to do everything, and it's awesome. I mean, each of these things have really good things and really good and drawbacks every single stage. Even as we feel like we're expanding and improving, bigger problems come with that. So there are challenges at every step. But order, it's given us a really nice, comfortable place to grow and to bump up against boundaries and understand who we are and have values and make us really good people. And the orange level is this achievement-oriented. We're very American, especially people outside of our faith and outside of our country keep telling me this. And so I'm listening. I don't see it because I'm in the soup, right? But we're very, very American in our ideals. And so we like to climb the ladder. Give me the 5-step program to get me to the celestial kingdom. You know, this is kind of where we are. And our leading edge is leading into love. I see that. I believe that. And I will just say that I think individuals get here faster than institutions. Institutions move more slowly than we do. So, you know, I think Sunstone tends to draw a fairly progressive crowd. So I think we have access to kind of what that loving edge is, and we all have those hopes and dreams for that loving edge, and maybe sometimes get frustrated that the ship isn't turning quite as quickly as we would like it to. And I would also like to say that there are times when I'm just amazingly surprised at how quickly things do change. So we're a wonderful, complex, just soup of all of this. So given that, I'll just get into some quick prognostication. So when we shift toward, I mean, if we're at the blue-orange now, I would imagine in 30 years, we are going to be shifting more from into the orange-green. We're gonna add more of that love. So I just want to say, what does that look like, right? What does that consciousness expansion? We're going to have a little bit more of a world view. We're not just going to take in us and maybe say that the world is awful and we've got it all. You know, I think we have to start taking in that other people, we have more access, the younger people, millennials especially, we are growing up with access to other people in an unprecedented way. So I think that we will start to see that reflected even more and more. Respect for other people's perspectives. Maybe we won't just think we've got the only way to do it. Perhaps we'll actually live up to some of the ideals of Joseph Smith of being a repository of truth wherever it comes from, even from the heathens and from the people, you know, we may not agree with, that we'll bring some of that truth in. I think we'll be a little more introspective and be able to deeply question the way we do things. Why are we doing that? We have these temple recommend questions. Why? How relevant is that to me actually serving and having this communion in the temple and connection with my ancestors? Like we'll be thinking a little more deeply about the structure and what we're doing. I think we'll have more acceptance of diversity. Hopefully we can be a more welcoming place for diversity. I hope we can be a more listening place for diversity in the church in many, many different ways of diversity, just among people with different ideas, different races, different backgrounds, different countries. I hope we get a little less American. That's my hope. More creativity in the way we do things. You know, we tend to kind of, we like conformity at our stage of growth. So it's like, you know, what I think we'll be able to access a little more creativity of how are other people doing it. When you become open to more ideas, we become more creative in and of ourselves. And if we take more of, I think we'll loosen our need to always do it the way the authorities say. I don't think the authorities are going to give us that permission before we're going to try to take it ourselves. I think we're going to have to make that move. But that will open up creativity for us in the way we do things. Okay, I have to put in the challenges because that's what I do. Just be grateful you're not married to me. Okay, so we have a dedication to hierarchy. That has not loosened much since our dear beloved Brigham really made it a thing way back when. We are really, and it's part of that order, right? It works really, really, really well, especially for the people who want to keep us going one specific way, and we have one good way to do it, okay? That's going to be hard to change. We can only change that from the top, and they're the ones in charge. It's a conundrum. Lifetime apostleship callings. These people get in there, and they're in there for a very, very long time, and it's the same people with the same view, and they're the ones that make the decisions, right? One of the big things with this is they also are the people for whom the system works. The reason they're in their callings is because it works for them. They have the privilege in the system that makes it, the personality and the upbringing and the economics and the education and all the different ways to say, this just works for me. Well, that across the board in humanity, in all institutions, gives us a handicap in seeing what the problems with the system are. And when it works really well for you and you hear someone for whom it doesn't work, we tend to say, well, just get with the program and do it the way I do it, because it works, because I'm evidence, look at me, right? And so that's really hard. We don't have a very good system right now for the margins to be heard. And maybe there is, and I'm not aware of it. I just know that I feel in the margins in some ways, in just a couple of ways. I don't know how to be heard. I don't know how to be heard in any meaningful way. It's a frustration. It's hard. Okay. And then the leadership is self-replicating. So I went to the actuarial tables to kind of see who's going to be in charge in 30 years. I will kind of be most likely passed to Bednar presidency. Let's really hope we're passes, but yeah.
That's when transgender.
Yes, well, that's a whole different thing. But we'll be past that. And it really, for quite actually, probably most of the current leadership will be gone. And so I'm like, woohoo! And then I think, oh no, they self-replicate. The people, they are the ones choosing the people who come up, right? And even the recent research by Jana Rees showing the millennials, yeah, a lot of them are leaving. Yeah, a lot of them are more open-minded. But guess what? The ones that are staying are pretty dang dedicated, even more, maybe more so than their parents. And I don't know that that's where they will stay as they age. Remains to be seen. But this is where my pessimism comes in, and my realism that is squashing all of my lovely hopes and dreams to live in Jay's world. So I've talked about the privilege. So this is also something I just have to bring up, and I don't mean this as a criticism. I say this about myself. I say this about humanity. But we're run by ego. And a recent survey, a study done on narcissism and ego, showed that the group with the highest percentage of ego and narcissism was clergy. It makes some sense when you think about it, because they have people around them telling them they're awesome all the time. Yes, men, you're great. You're doing it the best. There's not a lot of challenge going on. Do not question. Don't question me personally, for sure. And I speak for God. So Richard Rohr, my mentor, always says, the only thing worse than a separate self is a Christian self, separate self. Because now I've got God on my side telling me that my way and my ego and my biases and my things are the will of God. So this is what's putting a damper on myself living in Jay's world too soon. I think we'll get there. I just might be longer than 30 years for me. Okay, so I think it's going to be different individually than institutionally, because I think we move faster as individuals. And you see this depending, priesthood roulette, you know, which area you live in, who are your neighbors, it's going to look different. Individually, and I think, as Jay said, I think we're definitely going to be getting more and more and more LGBTQ acceptance on a local level. We're already seeing more and more of young people able to come out, be themselves, and have more family support than ever before. And I think that's just going to continue, and especially in 30 years. And I kind of also looked at this as a guide. We kind of run about 30 years behind the rest of the world. So in 30 years, we'll probably be where the rest of the world is now. And we're getting there. We're getting there with at least our LGBT acceptance. I think we're still, as a world and as a people, way behind on the others. But more gender equality. I think that women will continue to, will recognize the strengths of women, will give them more ways to have a voice. I definitely see that happening. More creative and expansive ways to serve. So I was thinking about this. I think as we become more aware of the world, maybe we'll think beyond just, I need to take a casserole to my neighbor who had a baby. And maybe we'll think, oh, what are the poor in my area needing? What are the refugees in my city? What can I do to help the poor and the needy beyond just my LDS bubble? I think we're going to be there. I think we're going to have more willingness to show up in vulnerable ways with each other. I'm also seeing this in groups. It's really hard. I think when we went to the councils in January of last year, let's all meet in a circle and let's chat. I think that is really hard, a shift for a lot of people with personalities and maybe prominently older people, but I think the younger people are really, this Brené Brown stuff is really starting to seep into all of us, and we're wanting to show up and be real and be seen and be heard. I think we'll have this deeper in exploration of our inner world. We're going to be more about transformation and not just transactional. And hopefully less discomfort with differentiation. We've got a real problem with this. The first person, we're so nice as Mormons, the first person that says something in a classroom, we're like, I thought differently in that, but that sounded good, and I don't want to make anyone uncomfortable, so I'm not going to say it. I think we've got to learn to own our voice and to say, and not say, this is the way it is for everybody, but understand when you take in other perspectives, you can say, this is my perspective, and this is how I am internalizing that. And that'll give room for someone else to say, yeah, I feel it very differently. And we're okay with each other, and we can still be in community and love and learn from one another, actually in really exciting ways. I love this. I really am looking forward to this one. Prayers with a wider scope. This is going to sound really terrible. I'm a one, remember. Prayers with in LDS faith, once I started being at the Living School and hearing all kinds of other people pray, sound like this. We're so grateful to be us, and help us to be more us. And, and just thank you for being us. It's all about us and praying for us, about us. And, I just notice in other congregations, there's more awareness of the wider community beyond their walls. So I really look forward to that. Prayers that take in more of humanity. Okay, institutional. And I have a more likely and a less likely. They're my pie in the sky. But I think more likely, I think we're going to have revamping of missionary programs. We're still doing 19th century missiology. And I would really like to see us step into something a little more meaningful in people's lives, really into ministry, service, and invitation and showing people how to do things that the way we do it is better, or has a unique way that maybe has something for you to join with us in doing something good. So a little less driven by let's have the truth claim and let it be about that. So I'm hoping for reorganization to include more women in decision-making, at least. I don't know that I'm right there with thinking we're going to have full priesthood for women, although I wouldn't rule it out. But I would say that there will maybe be a restoration back to what we've at least once had in the church, with women doing blessings, maybe with Relief Society authority being more on an equal par. I don't see men giving up the final say anytime soon, I'll be honest. But I do see maybe Relief Society's getting, a little more parity. Gender parity and sailing practices. I'm really hoping that the ghost of eternal polygamy has an impact. Temple recommended interview questions, like Jay said, let's just cut it down. Can we just ask the first and second great commandments? Are you there? Great. You feel worthy? Let's go. More heart, less checklist. Word of wisdom updates to reflect current actual science and health and, good ideas on taking care of ourselves. And better resources for faith growth and transition and diversity in that way. We really need some resources. You can tell this is what I do for a living. Less likely, really quickly, backing away from Scripture's literal history. I think maybe we can head there and make room for it at least. And if it's literal for you, that's great. And if it's not, maybe there are gifts there we can mine. Full priesthood for women. I still think the ultimate authority will still be male. more parity in generals. Maybe we'll have a male primary president. How fun would that be? You know, as men enter more of the child-rearing thing and we're becoming more responsive, I thought that would be kind of fun. More acceptance of the transgender. Hopefully the transgender and non-binary identifications can catch up a little bit with our LGB. And pie in the sky, same-sex temple marriage. I hope we can get there. I hope that we can really include all of us more and more as God's children with every access to all saving ordinances and growth in God. So that's it. That's where I'm at.
That demonstrates not only the wisdom of choosing one like Jana, but that a woman's voice and vision bring in perspectives that we not only would like, but are essential. I mentioned that I sent out a questionnaire to a number of people asking them to imagine the church of the future and also asked them just to give me one thing that they would like to see changed right now. And there's a variety of responses, but I decided that the leap from 2020 to 2050 was a little bit too hard to make in one attempt. So what I've done is taken those and done a more evolutionary progression to 2050. So this is kind of a summary of the things that I see, that other people see happening, that I've tried to integrate into a plan for the future. 2020, concerned with the threat about global warming, the church becomes a world leader in addressing climate change. It begins to refurbish all of its design for its chapels. They become multi-use during the week when nobody's using them. They have plant gardens and orchards around every chapel so that the members of the church can harvest food for themselves and feed the near poor. They use the chapels for homeless shelters and schools when they're not being used for church services. And because of this, the church grows by 3%. Imagine what would happen if the church really said, we are going to lead all churches in taking care of the earth. It is our great collective stewardship, and they begin doing things that are really bold. The church uses renewable energy. It does all of these things. And all these other churches say, wow, look what the Mormon church is doing. And they fall in line, and we hopefully save the planet. 2021, the church establishes humanitarian mission. Hopefully it might not be necessary, but on the borders. And they call all of the stakes on the Mexican side and the American side to create shelters and places to nurture those people who are fleeing. And then they also begin building churches and refugee centers and farms and orchards in the Northern Triangle of all those people who are fleeing from that. In 2022 or 2023, the church established a new program. All bishops and stake presidents have to, before they begin their calling, they have to take a three-month or six-month training session that teaches them how to counsel, how to listen, how to administer, and they go through that continue education. They spend weekends and computerized education so that when they finally begin their ministry, they know a lot more than they currently do. In 2024, the church apologizes for all of its mistreatment of blacks and minorities and LGBT people and begins a whole new program of reaching out to those people. And in the April 2024 General Conference, the church gives a complete accounting and transparency in all of its financial matters, and 200,000 people come back to the church. In 2025, the church institutes a program specifically designed to stop the outflow of younger millennials and to recover them. In every stake, the church established an alternative ward where people who have a little bit of time in a conventional ward can go and make fellowship and hope that the whole stake does not become alternative. Another 200,000 inactive saints return to activity. Church membership increases by 5%. 2027, the church announces we'll take care of all of its malnourished children by providing them with supplements and nutrition necessary for normal, healthy growth. Every ward in the developed in the developed world is paired with and adopts a stake. My stake in San Rafael, my San Rafael stake, has adopted a stake in Guatemala with 100 children, and we do an annual drive to provide for those children. In 2030, the church sanctions gay marriage for time and says it leaves eternity in the hands of God. Marriages are conducted by bishops in ward buildings, and gay families are welcome to participate in all services and activities. Transgender saints are accepted. 300,000 LGBT members and their families return to the church. 50,000 LGBTQ people are converted to the church. 2033, all missionaries divide their time between proselytizing and humanitarian service with a year for each. Missionary baptism is increased by 10%. 2033, Heavenly Mother is acknowledged as a member of the Godhead, and members are encouraged to include her in their prayers. Women and girls are given the priesthood and have the privilege of serving all ward and stake positions, performing all the ordinances, once open only to male members. The church provides a computer for every family, including inactive families. Recipients are only required to watch 1 hour of church-sponsored programs a week that are devoted not to proselytizing, but to strengthening marriages and families, instructing in parenting, budgeting, food storage, nutrition, sanitation, and the family members get free education via remote instructions. Many women return to activity. Women converts account for 5% increase in membership. 3035, the first president of Quorum of the Twelve established emeritus status for age 20 for all of them. A second Quorum of the Twelve, comprised simply of ordinary members, is formed, and they become a bridge between the ordinary members and the Council of the Twelve. 2037, recognizing the cross as the central symbol of Christianity, the church places crosses on all of its meeting houses and temples and encourages its use in other ways. The church revises its worship service to focus on truly worshiping God, both Mother and Father, and celebrating the mission and atonement of Jesus Christ, and the church celebrates Holy Week throughout the church. That's obviously Bob Reese's. 2040, church leaders, seeing the increasing danger of war and violence, undertake a major peace initiative, sends emissaries from the Quorum of the Twelve, and calls special peace ambassadors to all areas of conflict. The absence of policy of nonviolent resistance proves conscientious objector status for those who members who worship. Recognizing the doctrine and covenant saying that Zion will become the only place where people will be able to find refuge in the last days, it begins buying large sections of land which can be self-sustaining refuges for those fleeing war and violence. The church receives a Nobel Prize, Peace Prize. Membership increases by 20%. 2045, the church establishes a 5-year plan for celebration of a jubilee, a practice of ancient Israel celebrated every 50 years, which includes the forgiveness of all sins and all debts. The church invites other faiths and other nations to participate in the jubilee celebration, including storing goods and everything so that it make possible for even the poor countries to participate in the jubilee celebration. Membership increases by another 10%. 2050, what you've all been waiting for. A jubilee year of celebrating throughout the world as other religions and nations joining the celebration. Christians who envision the second coming not as to come to do away with all of the violence decide that it's time for them to prepare the world as a gift back to Christ, as a peaceful world in which Christ gave it to us in the Garden of Eden. So everybody works to give that to God instead of waiting for a violent end and second coming. As John Lennon sang, imagine, it isn't really hard to do. So for the next 5 minutes, we'd like to turn the time over for anybody who wants to do some wild and crazy or even safe imagining to come to the this microphone here and give us your ideas for what the church will be like in 2050, and then I'll conclude with some final words. And we do, for those of you who might worry about going over, we started late because of technological problems. We have a five-minute technological break. So since there are no sessions right after this, we might go a little bit longer. Thank you.
I think that's a church that we can all stand for. I wanted to know, first off, will your presentations, I'd love, Jay, I'd love to have yours, all three of yours, it'd be wonderful to have. So those are wonderful imaginings, and those are things, some things that
I'm not known, by the way, for being practical.
What was that? Oh, what? You're not practical? So much of that's going to be bottoms up revelation, right? And so much of that bottoms up revelation is leaving before the revelation can actually go up, that we're losing it. And so that's the struggle, right? For me, is how do we help not just myself try to stay, which I'm ebbing and flowing week to week after 12 years. How do we do that so that we can continue that process? And I'll just kind of leave that to anyone of the three.
Jay or Jenna?
I just need to get my thoughts together. Okay, distill that down for me again, just really quickly, just that last part.
How do we keep the people who have this bottom right? Because these are all surveys of people here that you've asked. Mm-hmm. And to get an answer like that, those are the people that are today speak are on their way out the door. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah.
And so then that won't happen, right? So how do we do that and navigate that? So
It happens. It happens really, really slowly. We have evidence of it having happened in the past. We've had a lot of bottom-up revelation in the past. But, for me, I think the quickest way we can do this is to start allowing space for people to be themselves within the church. We've got to have spaces where we can say what we feel, and it's safe to do it in community, in that diversity, that differentiated conversation that I'm talking about. So, I think it would be amazing if we could even just start having teacher development classes where people are really taught how to be a discussion holder and ask the kinds of questions that really pulls out what is in the room from everybody, especially from the margins, especially from people who maybe right now are feeling very intimidated and silenced. I think that is going to be the quickest way to start getting that to bubble up.
What was your name?
Trace.
Trace, thank you. I really felt your heart on that. Sorry. I just have a deep belief that we are going to get there. I had an impression after that 2013 exclusion policy, after the prophet called it revelation and he became a prophet. Shortly after he became a prophet, I had this strong sense that he was going to call it back. And he's not a young guy. So in my mind, that meant that it was going to have to happen fairly soon. I'm not the only one that had that impression. There's bigger things going on than the practicalities here. So I love Jana's idea. I don't see that happening anytime soon. I do see that whether it's a John DeLynn leaving and taking people with him, that has definitely an impact on the church. For me, I don't think it's necessarily negative. I think the church is paying attention. I mean, these are not stupid people. They do care. They care that the church, they have relatives. They have people they care about that are leaving.
So, Jay, can we keep and moving with...
Yeah, so anyway, I have a lot of hope that you'll be okay.
Sister Kirkham.
I have a couple of things that weren't mentioned. I think that there'll be a point which we have... we take care of the elderly, and we have... The business of the church is helping local communities take care of the elderly, whether it's a cooperative effort between a state and city, but we just give more attention to them. Secondly, I want, this is a longer word process, but I want to know, I want people in the church to know about process, how and why something happens in addition to what. I want to be able to say, oh, this is what we're going to do. Well, I don't feel like my contribution will be necessary here. Let me give somebody else that they're candid about their ability and what they can do. And then the way I named the gender issue was I said, women and men working together in diverse church communities under the nourishing guidance of the Savior have eliminated the presence of dominant male cultures in the church. That'd be a nice challenge. And then I also did a little spy stuff. I think the church keeps track of people, but I think we should have an organization in the church that literally looks at where is the hostility coming from and how can we best prepare the members for that. And it may mean that leaders have to think of ways of dealing with discomfort and danger.
Thank you. And I... I particularly like taking care of the elderly.
Yeah, can I just say one really quick response? I love that, and what I hear in that, and what I hear echoed in that, that speaks to me as a coach with inner work, is I think we will have that ability to create more ministries and services really driven from within, not just what the bishop tells us God has told us we could do, like, but just really have it come, the work of God come through us and create the kind of ministries that you're talking about. I love that.
Please.
I just lost my thing I was going to bring up here. But
take a second. Go ahead. Okay.
I wanted to just talk about the institutional challenges.
Pull that up.
I want to talk about the institutional challenges, and I'm really worried about the church. You know, a lot of us have spent our lifetime serving in it and building it. And what I see out of the leadership, I'm very disappointed with, because I think we have huge power, we have huge resources and availability, and I see it almost going the opposite of where I'd like to see it going. So I'm a little disappointed. And what I see with the institutional challenges, I think traditionally you saw a lot of top down. With the internet now and with the way that our society, to everybody's point here, it's a bottoms up approach. And you can see in religion, in government, and in business, those that are top downing now are failing. And the ones that are listening to the population, you look at a corporation like Amazon or these, they know 360 million people, they're intimate with them. They know them, they know their customers. And they're providing value to that. And if you do not provide value, people will not get behind you. And the thing that I wanted to bring up here was, I think just a key point of that, is I was very disappointed when they came out and said, we do not apologize. And we all know there's problems. We all know that mistakes are made. We're all forgiving people. We teach a religion of forgiveness. But when somebody says that to 360 million people, and pokes the bear, that's a bad thing. And I think that you're starting to see society lead, and I wish that we would lead this. So for instance, you take a Wells Fargo who got caught creating accounts that were not. And soon after that, they came out with they came out with a new slogan that said, established in 1852, reestablished in 2018. Mm-hmm. And you think about that, that's a big, powerful organization saying, we made a mistake, we're gonna clean up our act, and we're going to adjust to you.
And they're doing it because they have to, and the church is going to have to do something because the exodus of the millennials and youngers. And so going back to the question you asked before, what do you do? What are our alternatives? Essentially not to do anything, or to say there's so much good here that we can build and work toward that future. And you're right about the bottom up. It's interesting that so many things like Sunday school, the welfare program, the perpetual education program started at the grassroots level and came in. So now it's just to see how to penetrate that, what we perceive as a barrier to that.
But if government and businesses are getting that and they're starting to get that, and we see that out in society, but you know, when we go to the church, we're treated that other top down, it's going to be ugly.
I might also say just a very quick word, is that we tend to think of the brethren as in a monolithic mindset. There are enormous differences and disagreements, and some of them are very progressive. They work together, but sometimes the wheels grind immensely slowly. We have another, maybe one other statement. Yes?
Can I make one comment? Yeah. Can I say one thing to that? I think that as we do our inner work and are able to see our own shadows, like in that vulnerable way of the Brené Brown thing that's seeping in, eventually it will go institutional. Right now, we can't stand to see our own shadow. When someone shows us our shadow, we excommunicate them. But eventually, that inner work will come forward. It will understand that that's the way to transformation and integration, but it's going to take a while. But I think that will catch up to us, and eventually we will have to apologize.
I just have a quick, I want to know if you guys know something that I don't. We say the church says we don't apologize. My understanding, it was an instant reaction by Elder Oaks during that press conference where they were saying, we want religious freedom, and these are the things we're working on, and so therefore we're willing to play, in the LGBT market and stuff like that. Does anyone know that it's ever been stated from a conference pulpit or something? But we've just, in my mind, we've just this as like, the church says it. I have a feeling there's lots of inner work.
What I would say in response is that...
Let Bob finish there.
Okay. What I would say in response is that it's easy to start believing in apologies when they come and you hear them. So it may not be that there is a formal, we don't apologize, but when apologies begin happening, I think it's going to be easier to believe them. This young woman had something to say. You can be the last one before we conclude. Yes.
I don't know about going out on this note, but okay. So this might seem kind of petty, but to me it's important. I think that there needs to be a change in the design of the temple garment. Getting dressed with them, it's like a daily war. I'm not kidding, especially for women. So, they're not very practical in the heat. They need to be more accommodating for different clothing styles. As a creative, self-expression, that's a huge thing for me, and it feels very limiting, and it would help a lot of women with confidence. I know they say, there's a quote saying, don't alter the garment to, fit the clothing, but it's the original garment design went down to the wrist, so, if they made that much change, what more is making, a tank top version or something? The important part, the symbols, they're not even on the sleeves, so, anyway.
Thank you. The church, the garments have undergone changes, and I think we can count on the fact that they will continue to do so. Someone observed that you think that a church that could build a tabernacle without nails could be a pair of garments that would hold together.
Can I say one more thing about it? I just think that the biggest problem that comes as a byproduct of the current design of the temple garment is that people use it to try and judge the faithfulness and the status of activity of the members. It's just a huge shame that something that's supposed to be personal and sacred as the wearing of the garment between the Lord and the wearer is instead weaponized as a way to judge the members. So change of the design.
Thank you. And you're young enough that you will actually see the change in garments by 2030. I won't. Okay, the final.
I hope this doesn't go on record.
It is. It's on record.
A solution for her dilemma. I think we should just all get the symbols, which is the most important part of the temple, of garment, tattooed on in our various parts. That way.
Well, after the Second World War, when the church authorities were finally able to go into East Germany, they found that since there was no way to get garments into those people, the people had shorts, underpants with a string going down to the knee with a symbol on the. So let's hope for that. Let me take a few minutes to try and summarize what we've said, and I am going to take a couple of minutes over. If you have to go to some important thing, then do that. John Berger observes, imagining constellations did not change the stars, nor did it change the black emptiness that surrounds them. What it changed was the way that people read the night sky. So our task in opening our imagination is to read the night sky of the church's future, not only through the lens of spirituality or technology, but spirituality. Whatever world we have seen, whatever technology we have imagined, what remains is the moral lens through which we look at the future. And if that lens remains the gospel, and if the way in which we look at that through that lens is through love, then our future has a much better chance. In a book a friend of mine has written, contrary to what we normally suppose, the lens through which we most deeply and most clearly see is the eye of the lens of love. Love has the power to transform everything, including love. As my friend Ray Bradley says, interacting with the incoming fields of energy radiating from all objects and events, the ongoing energy fields of love operate like a holographic lens, which helps us not only see, but to transform the world. The authors of A General Theory of Love state, only a few things worth knowing about love can be proven, and just a few things amenable to proof are worth knowing. And I think as Latter-day Saints and as Christians, we both know and understand that. So let me just say this. I believe that the future we imagine is embedded in the promises of the restoration envisioned by Joseph Smith. If in the church we can imagine change beyond policy and practice, even change beyond doctrine, we have the possibility of becoming agents of change and thereby helping to transform the church, perhaps liberating it from some of its less enlightened traditions, policies, and practices, and even help glorify it in new ways. Is it possible to imagine such a future? Ihab Hussain said this, liberations come from some strange region where the imagination meets change. We need to reimagine change itself, else we labor to confirm all our errors. It seemed to me that as much as anything, our calling is to reimagine change through the lens of love, and then to transform our lives, our church, and the world beyond through the passionate attention and intention of what Bradley calls big love, by which he means not the kind of love you see on a certain TV show, but rather the kind of love embodied in the life and mission of Jesus Christ, the most powerful and transforming force in the future, for now and forever. Thank you.